Movement disorders are nervous system conditions that cause abnormal motions, involuntary tremors, stiffness, and imbalance. These symptoms can be painful and debilitating. And while we've made huge leaps in diagnosing and treating these disorders, where they come from largely remains a mystery. Today on the Health Report, we're looking at one movement disorder in particular. You'll learn about an ugly history of diagnosis, treatment through serendipity, and the mental weight of a physical condition. Jake Morecambe with this story.
I was standing on the train to go into the city for my work and got a bit of a pain in my neck. And I thought, ouch, that hurt. I wonder what that was.
It started, I had my second daughter, and within 6 weeks of having her, my head fell over. My head was on my left shoulder and I couldn't get up and started spasming.
For Robin and Paul, these bizarre neck pains and movements came out of nowhere.
I just thought, ouch, like you can pull a muscle, put some deep heat onto it or some anti-inflammatory cream or stretch it or hot towels and, you know, the usual kinds of things that you'd imagine to do. But none of those things did help. That developed into something more sustained.
The head went backwards and the face the right, and pain because the muscles are overused, they just ache.
Everyday tasks became increasingly difficult.
You can imagine if you put your head over like that, you can't see where you're walking. You can't see anyone walking beside you. When you'd lift anything, the head would be worse.
There was a time in my life when I couldn't even eat well with a knife and fork. I struggled to do some basic things like sign a credit card statement, because back then we didn't have, you know, tap and go. So every transaction, every time I went out to make a purchase, I had to face a terrifying thing of having to sign a piece of paper and be watched and stared at.
But wherever they went and whoever they asked, no one knew why this was happening.
Led me to go on to physiotherapists. They tried for months to no avail.
I probably went for a couple of years. No one knew what was wrong.
I'd seen doctors, GPs, acupuncturists. Chiropractors, one chiropractor said, look, in 10 sessions, I'll have you cured. But after 10 sessions, and of course, paying him for 10 sessions, nothing transpired except continued distress.
With the pains and spasms only getting worse, it started taking a serious toll.
Yeah, there were times when I couldn't sleep because I'd be lying down and my head would be turning into the pillow. It'd be just forcing its way to the right into the pillow. And I mean, I was absolutely destroyed by it. And it's the darkest period in my life.
I had another daughter who was 5. We lived on the first floor. So I went home with this baby and I couldn't carry her up the stairs. Because you can imagine your head's right over, you can't see the stairs. The 5-year-old had to carry her. It was shocking.
After years of no answers, Robin and Paul finally received their diagnosis. And it was something neither of them had heard of before. Dystonia.
I have cervical dystonia, which is the neck.
Which was just so left of field.
So dystonia is a neurological movement disorder. It's classified as a rare disorder, even though it's the third most common movement disorder after Parkinson's disease and essential tremor.
This is Lindley Bradnam.
I'm an associate professor of neurorehabilitation at the University of Auckland.
Lindley says dystonia is a brain network disorder. This means that parts of the brain stop talking to each other.
It is the messaging between different areas of the brain that is where the dysfunction lies.
Messages in the brain telling a part of the body to move or rest misfire and don't meet, which is what causes the dystonic symptoms.
In the traditional view of dystonia is the twisted postures and people not being able to control the movements. It's almost like the muscles have minds of their own. And tremor is a really common symptom.
Tremor is the uncontrollable and rhythmical shaking, also seen in Parkinson's disease. For the 70,000 people in Australia living with dystonia, these are the most common symptoms. But they're not the same for everyone.
Every person who has it has a different manifestation.
For Paul, there are two muscles in his neck that are the problem areas, the sternomastoid and the splenius.
Where are those? Are they like on the back of the neck or to the side?
Yeah, the sternomastoid is the one on the front of your neck, the main rotating muscle. And then the splenius is a deeper muscle. That's on the back right-hand side, the total opposite of the sternomastoid.
But dystonia isn't limited to the neck. There are many variations of the disorder, from blepharospasm, which affects the muscles around the eyes.
If you have dystonia around the eyes, your eyes want to close shut under their own control.
To focal hand dystonia, also called musician's or writer's cramp.
Where people practice a lot using the repetitive movements over and over and over, and they go on to develop dystonia.
And while dystonia can present in a number of ways, there's one common thread that binds everything together, the brain.
The majority of movement disorders are related to abnormal activity within the brain.
This is Dr. Stephen Tisch, a neurologist from St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney.
Electrical impulses in the brain that are then transmitted via the spinal cord and the peripheral nerves to the muscles. So it's the master computer that's controlling everything going on in the body.
When Paul and Robin were first diagnosed, this was about as much as we knew. Our knowledge ended at being able to identify what type of dystonia you had and that it all began in the brain. Everything else was a guessing game, including the medication Paul's neurologist prescribed him.
When I eventually got a diagnosis, he just sort of shrugged his shoulders, basically, and said, can't do anything for you, try this drug.
And what was that?
I don't know whether it was an antipsychotic.
Antipsychotic?
Yeah, I believe so. And I looked at it and I thought, why? And truly, I threw it away. I thought, I don't know what to think about the doctor.
Lindley Bradnam says prescribing people with antipsychotic drugs was common practice because up until about 20 years ago, dystonia was considered a psychological disorder.
They thought it was a hysterical type disease because people will present with different body parts and twisted, non-functional positions. And just the unknown nature of what was causing the movement disorder meant for some reason it was considered to be more of a hysterical or a psychological disorder.
Paul experienced this with his neurologist, which felt like a slap in the face.
I won't give his name because I don't have a high opinion of him, because I found him a callous person, someone who was indifferent and I felt uncaring. I was an object of curiosity, somewhat.
Shortly after, Paul stopped seeing that neurologist.
So you throw the medication away that you've been prescribed.
Mm.
Where to from there? What happened after that?
That's what led me on this journey. And I was determined to beat this somehow.
Why don't we know where it comes from?
We are honing in on it. The research is sort of fining down on these different areas.
Lindley says dystonia doesn't appear on a brain scan, and that's because the problem is in the messages the brain is firing off, not the brain regions themselves. But there are new technologies helping us unlock what's written inside.
Advances in imaging and advances in the different techniques we have of looking at the brain is really helping to close down the areas of the brain that are involved.
Stephen Tisch explains there's an MRI practice called diffusion tensor imaging tractography, or DTI, that's helping us read these encrypted messages.
There have been a number of studies that have shown that at a very microstructural level, some of those fibre bundles enlarge or change in shape in patients with dystonia. Now, these changes wouldn't be readily visible on a standard diagnostic MRI, but using these specialised techniques, there is a difference.
Do you think that's where a lot of these answers lie, in these messages, and if we can utilise these technologies to, you know, hone in and start unpacking and unlocking what's happening?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it'll probably be a convergence of understanding, improvements in imaging, developments made within the genetic fields.
Stephen believes genetics research is crucial in uncovering where dystonia comes from. In some cases, the presence of a particular gene can be the direct cause of dystonia. In others, it's a contributing factor.
You can think of it almost as though the gene may be creating the conditions in which dystonia can develop, sort of like a soil.
But not necessarily being the underlying cause.
And not necessarily being the only cause. And then there may be further environmental factors which then, acting on that fertile soil for dystonia, then produce the fully fledged syndrome of dystonia.
An example of this is blepharospasm, dystonia in the muscles around the eyes. If someone carries a blepharospasm gene and is frequently exposed to sunlight, there's evidence to suggest that their dystonia could be a learnt behaviour.
So we all blink naturally to glare and bright light, and it could be a case that the natural blink response in response to environmental light could be in training movement patterns which then become effectively autonomous involuntary movements.
However, Stephen explains these ideas aren't widely accepted. He also adds there are significant gaps in genetics research and that it doesn't tell us everything. For example, you can carry a gene for dystonia but have no symptoms.
That's the concept of reduced penetrance. So a person can have a dystonia-causing gene, but they're absolutely free of dystonic symptoms.
And vice versa. Some may experience the symptoms but not carry the associated gene.
Even when we use arguably the most sophisticated methods for genetic analysis that we currently have, which include things like whole genome sequencing, we don't always find a gene.
This is what happened to Robin. When they ran her against the known cervical dystonia genes, there wasn't a match.
Every time a new gene's found, they'll run us against it.
Robin isn't just waiting on answers for herself, but for her daughter as well.
That daughter that I developed this after having her, she now has writer's cramp, which is the hand spasms, and her jaw and shoulder now going into dystonic tremors.
She's hopeful one day they'll find a match to shine a light on where the dystonia came from.
Was there any previous trace of this of your family prior?
No. They tell us it's genetic, but the only thing we can think is that my grandfather and an uncle, who are both gone naturally now, had Parkinson's. Was it Parkinson's? Was it dystonia? We don't know.
You're listening to the Health Report on RN and a special feature on the movement disorder dystonia with Jake Morecambe.
After throwing away the antipsychotics he was prescribed, Paul felt lost. He was just told there was nothing he could do and that he'd have to learn to live with the endless neck pains and spasms. However, this all changed when he started seeing a new neurologist who invited him to take part in an experimental study.
It was about 1988. Of course I was interested because I had nothing else to help me. And I agreed to engage in this trial.
The trial was for a treatment called botulinum toxin, or as it's commonly known under one of its brand names, Botox.
Even though the main problem with dystonia is arising in the brain with abnormal activation of muscles, botulinum toxin injected into the end product, the overactive muscles, can yet be highly effective in relieving the symptoms.
This is Victor Fung, neurologist and clinical associate professor at the University of Sydney.
And why is that? Is it a temporary relief?
Yes, it's a temporary relief. So one of the mechanisms of botulinum toxin is that it stops the nerve talking to the muscle properly. So the muscle that you inject becomes weak, but over several months that weakness recovers and then the dystonia symptoms start to come back.
For the past 30 years, botulinum toxin has been the most effective treatment for dystonia. But still to this day, we don't fully understand why.
We suspect that that a component of the way that botulinum toxin works is by altering the message that the muscle is then feeding back to the brain.
Not fully comprehending why treatments work might sound strange, but neurologist Stephen Tisch says that's normal.
Sometimes understanding in terms of therapies can be a little bit ahead of our understanding of the underlying causes of disease. There are other situations in medicine where we have, often through serendipity, through chance discoveries, major breakthroughs have been made therapeutically, but have run ahead, raced ahead of our actual understanding of what drives the disease fundamentally.
You can ultimately treat a disorder when you don't fully realize its cause.
Exactly. Exactly. And I don't think we should be frightened of that, because at the end of the day, patients understandably want and demand therapy. And I think if we waited for every full disclosure of mechanisms before we took the step of developing effective therapies, we'd be waiting a very long time.
After participating in the trial and being injected with Botox, for the first time, Paul felt
relief. I think probably what I felt was just relief of tension in the muscles. The muscles that had been paining and straining so much were no longer paining and straining.
Some 30 years later, Paul continues to get a series of botulinum toxin injections every 3 months.
I'll get probably 9 or 10 injections all at once.
But having regular injections isn't a great experience for everyone.
Was it painful?
Yeah, it's not pleasant. But relief is what you're going for. It's not to look good, so.
Robin had Botox injections for more than 20 years for her dystonia. She says while they were tolerable, it's what came next she didn't look forward to.
You get home from these injections and absolute exhaustion. I always said if a truck came through the front of the house, I wouldn't have had the energy to move. I would have just gone, forget. So, and that lasts a couple of days and then you're back to normal and yeah, it's a strange, strange feeling.
One day, however, the Botox stopped working for Robin, and that's because she had developed a resistance to botulinum toxin.
And it wouldn't matter how much they put in, wouldn't work.
Dystonia expert Lindley Bradnam says this isn't uncommon.
They do tend to become a little bit less effective over time. The muscles that are injected actually atrophy and become quite small. And some people become resistant to the toxins.
And what was that like for you when you've been undergoing a treatment that all of a sudden stopped working?
It's terrible. Because you know there's nothing else they can give you.
When Botox was no longer an option for Robin, there was a new treatment starting to make waves in the dystonia space.
And then deep brain stimulation came along.
Yeah.
Deep brain stimulation, or DBS, requires brain surgery, which Lindley Bradnam says is a serious undertaking.
So there is a small hole made in the skull and the electrodes are implanted into the brain and the person has a stimulator implanted just under the skin, usually around their collarbone.
The function of DBS is to artificially drive messages around the brain.
Then it sends out all of those messages as they should to the motor cortex and the movements present well.
But Stephen Tisch, who is also Robin's neurologist, says the procedure isn't for everyone.
What made you realise Robin was ready?
Pretty much she reached the end of the road in terms of medical therapy and just was at a point where her cervical dystonia was very severe and also very painful. So there was, I think, a strong argument to take action.
That being said, Robin had some serious reservations.
It's drastic surgery. You know, you could have a stroke, you could have brain bleed, you could die. Like, it's, you're letting someone into your brain. And for the first part of the surgery, you're awake.
You're awake? So you're under local for the first part of it?
So it's all scary stuff, really. I don't like going to the dentist and hearing the drill in the other room. And I'm thinking, they're going to drill my head and I'll be awake. I'm not that keen on this.
But for Robin, it was either brain surgery or nothing. The surgery was a success, and fortunately for Robin, the recovery period was brief. Quickly, she noticed some big changes.
Do you experience any symptoms of cervical dystonia now?
I do have a tiny tremor, but to me it's been fantastic. Gave me my life back.
But Robin always knew that DBS isn't a cure, as there is no cure for dystonia. She also learnt dystonia treatments don't safeguard you against other types of dystonia. 3 years ago, Robin developed dysphonia.
What it is the vocal cords are spasming. Most people with it, their voices are very broken and very hard to understand. Mine's sort of mild.
Robin says the dysphonia diagnosis was a hard pill to swallow.
Where did dysphonia come from?
No idea. Just out of the blue, the voice started to crackle and then break, and I couldn't force the voice out. You know, when you're in a meeting or you're out for dinner and the restaurant's noisy and you're trying to push your voice out, it just wouldn't. Just couldn't do it. I just couldn't believe it. I thought I was over the hump and everything was fine, but yeah.
So when you started showing symptoms of dysphonia, what did Stephen say to you?
He just sat there with me and he just put his hand on mine and he said, "I'll always be here to support you." And I was quite down the dumps and I thought, yeah, you will be. So, yeah.
For Paul, his mental road to recovery has been just as important as treatment.
I did a lot of visualization, seeing myself being able to do things that I couldn't do things. I couldn't walk normally. I had to imagine myself walking properly. And I'd have positive affirmations to myself. I'd speak to myself. I was aware of the voice in my head that talked to us and say, "You're no good," or "You can't do this." But you have to replace those thoughts, substitute them with positive ones. And that's exactly what I was doing. I was turning defeat into saying I can do, I will do, and seeing myself doing it.
This is something Paul hopes others living with dystonia can take on board as well.
The common thing said for people with any kind of medical condition is don't give up. You have to keep on pushing forward. It's you who has to keep on battling. If you're not happy with that doctor, keep on pushing through. Keep on knocking on doors. Keep on seeking answers. Keep on asking questions. Just keep on looking, trying to find solutions to your difficulty. You can't give up.
Dystonia patient Paul, ending that report from Jake Morecambe. That's it for the Health Report. Thanks for joining me and see you next week.